So we're back on this new episode of Saintly Witnesses with Dr. Steve Millies, who's a professor of public theology at the Catholic Theological Union. And he's also the director of the Bernardin Center. So a very high profile political influencer we got right now, who's going to come on and share some crucial gems about our civic responsibility as voters and how to understand the Catholic framework of how to exercise voting responsibility with Catholic social teaching. So definitely thank you for coming on and providing these much needed gems right now as we get ready for the 2024 election.
I'm awfully glad to be here. I'm grateful for the invitation. This is an important year. Every election's important, and I used to make fun of the people who every election said this is the most important election of our lifetimes. It seemed like everyone was, but this one could be. So it's as I like to say, especially for Catholics who are serious about what we say we believe, it's time for all hands on deck. It's 2024. Let's go.
Yeah, I've heard. That's what I constantly hear, that this is like the make or break election. But I'm sure you're gonna give more information and insight on why this is such a crucial election as Catholics and what we can do. So my first question would be, as somebody who is a Catholic and who wants to understand, Catholic social teaching in the last 150 years, what are some good papal encyclicals and papal approaches to issues in like the last 150 years?
First of all, you can't really talk about Catholic social teaching beyond 150 years ago. There was social teaching, of course. There was social teaching in scripture, but the church only really turned its attention specifically to a social teaching with Leo XIII's encyclical Rerum Novarum in 1891. It's an important document. It's the document, like I say, that inaugurated modern Catholic social teaching. But it's actually, I assign it when I teach the course at Catholic Theological Union. I teach the course on Catholic social teaching there, and I assign it, but it's really quite dated. What's important about it is not so much mostly what it says, because what it was a response to specific historical and social conditions in industrial Western Europe. Those conditions don't exist in most places today. And certainly a lot of our students come from much different global contexts. In that classroom this year, I had students from Cameroon and Kenya, Burundi, China, Vietnam, all sorts of places. And it's always an interesting conversation to ask, what does a document like that have to do with where you've come from and where you'll probably go back to do ministry? The answer is, for what it says, not much. But the reason it's important was it's where the church first began to say that we need to look at what's happening in the world now and respond with the voice of justice, to ask what it is that Catholics should be doing and how we should be thinking about things. So Rerum Novarum is important because it did that. If we were looking for encyclicals to read, I'd really recommend Pacem in Terris, John the 23rd's 1962, I think, encyclical, where the church began to take notice of human rights. And this reflected the influence of the French philosopher Jacques Maritain, who was a close friend of Pope Paul VI, and who in 1948 had brought a perspective of Catholic social teaching to the creation of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But the commitment to human rights enters papal teaching and becomes part of our social tradition in Pacem in Terris. We'd want to look at Pope John Paul II's Evangelium Vitae. That I think is the pinnacle of his social teaching. I always like to give honorable mention to Sollicitudo Rei Socialis, his document on solidarity. But Evangelium Vitae is important because it enshrines human life as the fundamental concern of Catholic social teaching, and specifically endorses the consistent ethic at paragraph 87. But the last one I'll mention, and I think really the one I hope we'll spend most of our time talking about today, is Pope Francis's 2020 encyclical Fratelli Tutti. It's not to say that Laudato Si doesn't deserve attention. Both, in fact, I think have to be read together. But Fratelli Tutti is a long document. I'd warn anybody who went to read it. It's a long document, but it's a really important document in one way for a technical academic reason. I think what Francis has done with that document is he has summarized the whole Catholic social tradition to this point and reframed it with solidarity at its center. I think that's really important. So we can say in a technical way, Pope Francis has made Catholic social teaching with Fratelli Tutti primarily concerned with solidarity, with the things that we owe to each other in social life. But the other reason that it's important to read, maybe for a less technical reason, is it's where Francis summarizes what has been a quiet theme of his 10 years in the papacy. He's been calling us toward a better kind of politics since Evangelii Gaudium in 2014. But he's got a whole chapter in Fratelli Tutti about what he means by a better kind of politics, why we're called to it, and what that can mean for us. So, Rerum Novarum, Pacem in Terris, Evangelium Vitae, and Fratelli Tutti is the short answer, as the alternative to the long one I just gave.
Yeah, and Fratelli Tutti is like a really great encyclical. I remember reading it during like the height of the pandemic, and one thing that really stuck out to me was his whole section on the parable of the Good Samaritan and how he encouraged us to embrace empathy and like a radical sense of like selflessness to the condition of somebody who's in despair on that journey of the road. Which kind of brings us into our next question about the pontificate of Pope Francis. Like you said, he's been the Pope for like 10 years. What do you think about his pontificate and how has he managed to influence, major discourse within the church and on a global scale on issues?
Wow. I haven't called for his resignation. Others have. As recently as today. I think it's been extraordinary. I think it's been simply extraordinary. I'm one of these people who I have a former colleague at CTU, Dan Horan, who's now at St. Mary's College in South Bend, and I heard him say once at a meeting that too many Christians are third person of the Holy Spirit atheists. That is to say, we like to think, I think sometimes, and Francis has talked about this when he's talked about the real sin of our time as a kind of a Neo-Pelagianism. We like to think of ourselves, this is the heresy, Pelagianism. We like to think of ourselves as the real actors, the agents of our own salvation. And what it winds up doing is overlooking the role of grace and overlooking the role of the Spirit. Every pope brings something to the church. Some bring many things. I think what Francis has done has been extraordinary. And a lot of it is Fratelli Tutti. We'll talk more, I promise you, before we're done about that parable of the Good Samaritan and that long section in Fratelli Tutti, because I agree with you. But something else he's done that's just been extraordinary. Apart from the early Christmas gift of Fiducia Supplicans and some other things that he's done to really invite the whole approach of synodality and discernment to really invite us to a more committed and mature engagement, both as a whole church and individually with our spiritual lives, the real fundamental calling of the gospel. But what he's done with Fratelli Tutti, in addition to reframing everything around solidarity, Fratelli Tutti was, as you say, a pandemic document that came out at the height of the pandemic that also engaged the pandemic. It did that thing Leo XIII did in Rerum Novarum. It responded to exactly what the whole world needed to hear at that moment. So what I think I would say, to sum it up is, and this isn't a criticism of John Paul II or Benedict XVI, because as I say, every pope brings great gifts to the office. I think that having back-to-back professor popes tended to put the pastoral mission of the church on the back burner.
You're talking about John Paul and Ratzinger?
And Benedict XVI, it tended to foreground a kind of a catechetical approach to the faith, which we can't do without. But what Francis is doing is he's rebalancing that by emphasizing the pastoral dimension of the church's mission. It's just a question of emphasis, but I think in the way in which we see it in those daily homilies, we see it in in the off the hand off the cuff comments that he makes. He's a pastor more than a teacher. We need both pastors and teachers. To sum it up, I'd say Francis's pastorate has been extraordinary, and it's been what the church needed after two generations of two professor popes.
Definitely. And thank you for shedding light on that. The pontificate of Pope Francis. So as you talked about Fratelli Tutti and like some of the social, economic, and geopolitical issues that's within it, when we think about the election in 2024, what do you think are some contemporary hot button topics and how should we respond with a Catholic worldview on these issues?
Yeah. So before I answer that, I want to not answer that. Because I think it's important to say, I really think it's important that we notice and we think about how that's the wrong frame. Thinking about it in terms of issues and topics, I think has been what's gotten us Catholics in the United States especially into a lot of trouble across the last 3 or 4 decades, because we become so focused on fixing, let's name it, abortion. But it could be anything else. We become so fixated on achieving something on some particular issue or some particular topic that we become neo-Pelagians. We think that if we can do this, we will fix everything. We become captive to this idea that, sin will be gone from the world if we just overturn Roe versus Wade. All abortions will be over. Everything will be great. And we can vote that way for 5 decades. And never really achieve it until one day it is achieved, and well, not all that much has changed. And in fact, last year the Pro-Life Committee of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops indicated its willingness to accept a 15-week restriction on access to abortion, which would permit 94% of the abortions available under Roe. It was a bit like saying to the Catholics of the United States, we told you this all had to change for 50 years, then it changed, and now we didn't really want it to change in the first place. I think, in other words, thinking in terms of topics and issues tempts us toward a kind of a partisan approach to political life that's a big part of what I've tried to pull us back from with the new book. What I'm trying to say with the book, and what I'd say here in response to the question, is that we really ought not to think in terms of what's the most important issue, or what's the most important topic, or what's the preeminent priority. We ought to be guided by that parable of the Good Samaritan. My actual training is in political science. I taught political science for 15 years. I've now been made a theologian by fiat by my current employer, God bless them. I'm trying to become one every day. But as a political scientist, what I know is that voting is a complex behavior, and very few votes in very few elections actually wind up changing all that much. Voters have to engage in a complex reflection on what can my vote actually change in this election, given the priorities that are in front of us? What's the most effective thing that I can do with this vote? And so what I suggest is that the way to approach voting with that in mind is to ask the question that we ask with the parable of the Good Samaritan, the question that Francis invites us to ask in Fratelli Tutti. Proximately, nearest at hand, what's the good that this vote can do in this election cycle? And then one other thing to name, of course, too, going back to Thomas Aquinas, in ethical decision making, prudence is the important virtue. The idea of using the information that we have and exercising good judgment. But here again, we come back to the complexity of what voting is. We all have different information because of the news that we consume or don't consume, because of where we live, because of 1,000 things that political scientists study. Voters approach voting with different information. And in the light of the information we have, we all exercise our judgment differently. So I've always been opposed to the idea that we should say there's any preeminent priority that everybody should agree on. What we're all invited to do is to ask that question: what's the most good that I can do with my one vote that's most at hand right now? Voting for something abstractly or voting against something abstractly because it's wrong morally, I think that feels good, but we have 50 years of evidence that says it doesn't do much good. And in fact, a lot of other things got damaged along the way. I think from election cycle to election cycle, we're called to evaluate what's the good I can do this time? Because there's going to be a next time, and there's going to be a next time. And by the way, one last thing on that too, that gives us space to get it wrong, which we're going to do because we're human beings. This is one of the reasons why I've always made fun of the people who've said this is the most important election of our lifetime. It's the most important election of our lifetime until the next election, when we'll all do it again. When we make mistakes, we get chances to correct them in the next election cycle. And so, what I'm trying to say is that a more complex appreciation of what voter behavior is and a more complex appreciation of what our moral tradition says, rather than just ranking most important issues, a more complex appreciation of those things yields, I think, something that's both a little bit harder because it asks me to reflect a little bit more carefully and to go out and find information. But it's also easier because it relieves me from the burden of feeling like I have to fix it all with my, that the world is hinged and my salvation is hinged on how I cast this vote. I just don't think it's so. I don't think that's realistic morally or politically. So I tend not to like to talk about issues, but I am going to talk about one. And I'll just say, this is the last few pages of the book. I don't know what people will think about it. I gave a talk where I tested this out at a parish a couple of years ago, and it got a pretty good reception. But we'll see what happens when the book comes out. If there is one issue, it is the health of our political process. It's the capacity of our political community to solve its problems. Right now, the most important issue facing us is that our politics is broken. And we know that that prevents us from addressing a migration crisis. And we know that it prevents us from addressing abortion. And we know that it prevents us from addressing healthcare and poverty. We know that it prevents us from addressing important national security questions from Ukraine to the Middle East to the other parts of the world, too. So we need to take a greater interest in building a better kind of politics. To me, if we have to name a preeminent priority, if there's one issue, that's it. The most important thing is we need a healthier politics, one where we do a lot less finger pointing and a lot more thoughtful conversation.
Yo, man, you the political science theologian. We just in your world, so I appreciate you coming on and changing the paradigm shift. So, definitely good information to reflect on and to influence the discourse on how we view politics. So, definitely thank you for that. So, if we want to understand the essence of how to carry out the heart of the church's call to use our civic responsibility, where do we begin? I know the bishops, maybe it was a decade ago or so, they released a document on like our civic engagement or something like that, or something in the lines of that, to basically give voters how to properly use their vote. So how would we get to the heart of understanding our civic engagement and responsibility?
So one of the things that I do in the book is I take a look at the history of those bishop statements. And one of the things that becomes really clear is that those bishop statements have become increasingly captive to a kind of a partisan and intensely, in the wrong sense, political engagement with issues. And yet, I want to say too, in defense of the US bishops, there's a lot of history behind this that I won't talk about. It's in the book. But I want to say, in defense of the US bishops, these issues are complex. And I want to say, too, that the bishops, in addition to Pope John Paul II, the bishops have accepted the consistent ethic of life. as the basic framework for how to do what you're talking about, how to apply our citizenship as Catholics effectively in the world. You know, what is the consistent ethic of life? The consistent ethic is a conviction that goes, well, really back to the Second Vatican Council's Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World, Gaudium et Spes, which names a number of issues that continue to be named by the consistent ethic of life, which was proposed by Cardinal Joseph Bernardin 40 years ago last month in the context of nuclear war. At that time, the US bishops were asking questions about, given the imminent threat of nuclear war in the midst of an arms buildup during the Cold War, and given the threat of abortion as well, how do we square these two things? Because Catholics are, generally speaking, supporting a militaristic US foreign policy and yet at the same time opposing abortion. What Cardinal Bernardin and what the bishops at that time, and I think what the bishops since have tried to do, is to invite Catholics to be consistent witnesses to human life. So that, you know, means, for example, that we have to give careful thought to whether any nuclear war ever really could be a just war, one that destroys whole innocent populations, destroys cities, destroys the environment. Could it ever really be a just war? But we apply that to abortion, apply it to poverty, we apply it to racism, we apply it to education and healthcare and all of the other things that impact human life. The basic claim of the consistent ethic of life is that every Catholic always should be consistently in favor of what promotes human flourishing for everyone, period. From birth to natural death, at every point in between, every human life matters more than anything else in the universe. Each and every one of us, each and every human being is irreducible and irreplaceable. And so human life is our fundamental calling. We have to bear witness to it consistently. But here now, your question gets us to the hard part. How do I do that? How do I bear witness consistently? And this is why I talk about the parable of the Good Samaritan. Tip O'Neill, who was the Speaker of the House in the 70s and 80s, used to like to say that all politics is local. And what he meant was that we learn politics and we're most active, hopefully, in our local communities. I think sometimes it's a huge mistake to start thinking at the global level or the national level. We should be consistent witnesses to human life close to home first, because oftentimes that's the place where we can be most effective. So something I like to say to people is take real interest in local and state level races. Those are the things that deal with the issues that really do actually affect people in their everyday lives more than almost anything else. That's the good we actually really can do, is by being active locally and at the state level. And that's about helping the beaten person who's in front of me. I encounter the beaten man, and he becomes the most important thing. Right? The Good Samaritan encounters him in the parable, and this beaten man becomes the most important thing, more important than his journey, more important than his money. But we only do that in a real encounter. We only do that when we actually encounter someone proximately. So I think we really have to begin that way and lay our emphasis that way in a way, frankly, that a lot in our media narrative and our politics don't really encourage us to. We're really encouraged to think in terms of two sides of a football game, you know, something like that. And what we do just doesn't really affect it all that much. We can be far more effective at the local level. So far as, of course, we do vote in national races, well, then we have to ask those questions. What can my vote affect this time in this House race, in this Senate race, in this presidential election? What really will be different if one candidate or another wins? You know, one thing certainly about abortion, it seems pretty clear Trump has condemned the Florida restrictions and other restrictions on abortion for the first time since 1972. We're looking at the prospect that we'll have two major party nominees in Donald Trump and Joe Biden whose positions on abortion might not be all that different. Maybe it's time to start looking at other issues. And so I think that's where we ask that question, you know, what will be different? What will actually be different when I cast this vote? But really, I'd lay most of the emphasis at the local and state level.
Good answer. And you touched on our next question, You basically summed up that you said, the Catholic position is that we look for consistency for flourishing in human life and human journey. So in your upcoming book for Paulus Press called A Consistent Life Ethic, Navigating Catholic Engagement with U.S. Politics, what are some major takeaways you want readers to understand when they read the book?
I wrote the book to be a, and it's barely 100 pages. I wrote the book to be a very, I hope parishes, if anybody's listening, I'll talk to your parish on Zoom. I may even travel to you. I really want parishes to take this up because I think it's so important. So I wrote the book to be a very readable history of the consistent ethic and an explanation of it. But my real agenda is really simple. It's this, and it's what Pope Francis was talking about from Evangelii Gaudium to Fratelli Tutti, to recover a sense of what our politics really is. That's what the consistent ethic of life calls us to. That's what solidarity is all about. Politics, in its most simple and elemental sense, is an alternative to resolving our conflicts with violence. Without politics, all that's left is force and violence. Politics means we're going to try to do things with dialogue and discourse and procedures and rules, and we're all going to agree to them because we all fundamentally respect one another as members of the same shared human community. That's what politics is. Politics is peace as the alternative to warfare and violence. Conflict is inevitable, but we can resolve our conflicts peacefully or we can resolve them violently. In order to have politics, we really have to believe in a consistent ethic and in what a consistent ethic asks us to believe in. We have to believe in the fundamental dignity of every person I share the community with. We also have to believe that the community itself has value. That's a fundamental Catholic teaching. The community is prior to the individual. We are all persons in community. And so coming to an understanding of that and its relationship then to how we think about the political issues that come in front of us is really what the book is about. Finally, I think I'd say this, and I've kind of touched on it a couple of times here so far. We have a great temptation, I think, Catholic or not, to feel like our vote is somehow an expression of our identity. And that if we engage in compromises, if we make a complex choice that might not be the perfect thing that we want, I think sometimes we feel like we're in danger of moral collapse when we do that. But politics and community life means giving space to one another. It means dealing in complexity, gray areas, difficult things that sometimes require us to hold our nose. And that means that we have to distinguish our identity, who I am, from our common political community life together. So, in other words, every vote isn't the danger of a moral collapse if I compromise on this issue or that issue. Our vote isn't the same as our identity. Our vote is one prudently taken action, and then there will be others. Because I would want to say, too, and I often say this when I teach political science, voting may be the least important political behavior of all, because we only do it once every 2 years. The most important political behavior of all is watching the news, being well informed, being integrated into the life of your community, volunteering for organizations and campaigns. These are political actions, and they build up community. And again, they affirm our faith that we owe something to one another in social life because we come from a common creator who loves the person next to me, the person I'm talking to, as much as me. We have to live our lives bearing witness to that constantly. Politics is, I think, and I think Francis agrees about this. Politics is the best venue in which to do that, to really express our humanity that way. But it depends on our understanding politics that way and seeing it as an expression, not just of my humanity, but of my regard for yours as well.
That's a perfectly good answer and a good way to end the podcast. Definitely appreciate you sharing all your opinions and blessing us with your vital wisdom on political science and just the political process. So my last question, something I didn't prepare you for, this is like a gag question I typically ask people. So one of my favorite albums is Queen News of the World. I mean, I like a lot of Queen albums, but this album is like one of their first where they really became, or maybe not the first, but probably like the second, they demonstrated being masters of the studio, so to speak. So what's your favorite album and why is it such a influential album for you?
It's a great question. And also, I never have a good answer to questions like that. I'm terrible at picking favorite anythings because they change all the time. I'll say this. I've been listening to a lot of Talking Heads
Okay,
for the
big songs
last,
about food and music.
what's that?
Good.
Yeah, more songs about, or Remain in Light. Build more songs about buildings and food. That was what it was. My most recent Talking Heads obsession goes back actually about 6 or 7 years, and the reasons are kind of ridiculous. But I've been really amazed by the consistent voice that David Byrne has,
Yes.
and it's a voice that is so curious about what it means to be a human being. And it comes to life, certainly. Social issues are present. I think American Utopia was one of the most fantastic expressions of American art in the last quarter century, at least, for speaking to where we are right now, and also doing it with creativity and joy. What I think is the best of what art asks us to do. But Byrne's music is psychologically interesting. He ranges across a lot of American music, and a lot of non-American music too. He's recorded some opera, which doesn't quite have the voice for, but A for effort. But I guess if I had to choose one album, I would choose Everything That Happens Will Happen Today, which is an album Byrne did with Brian Eno, which is one that I listened to a lot. And a number of those songs were in the American Utopia show.
Okay. And Brian Eno was with the Roxy Music before
Yeah.
he went off and did his own thing. But I would definitely agree that the Talking Heads and the lyricism of David Byrne is definitely, he definitely is like a very perceptive songwriter, singer and songwriter, who's just so in tune with the human experience from different emotions, different genres. So that's a good point, a good pick, and definitely make me want to go listen to Talking Heads 77.
I'll say this last on it. He comes from a different planet, I'm sure of it. But the way that he addresses humanity speaks to the Catholic in me.
Okay.
There's a
That's
very I have a very Catholic read on David Byrne.
okay. That's definitely a
Probably
good way
surprise
in.
him.
You say it again?
That'd probably surprise him.
Okay. Well, I hope everybody enjoyed the conversation. I really appreciate you, Dr. Millies, for coming on and sharing once again this information about how we can best respond with our vote and be engage our community with the election cycle that's coming up. I think it was a crucial conversation, and I pray that your success as a political science theologian and your book success just is sold out and across parishes, and many people respond effectively to like the message that you have within. So thank you.
Ephraim, I'm really grateful for this invitation, and I'm very grateful for this ministry you have here too, not just on the podcast, but on social media too. I've enjoyed following you for quite a while, so I'm glad we got to meet this way.
Yeah, for sure. And may the listeners pray for the work that you do. And you guys can tune in to the next episode of Saintly Witnesses.